leading up to the 50th anniversary of that, probably the most famous tour in pop music history, the Powerhouse Museum, first in Sydney, and then it, the exhibition goes on to Melbourne in 2014, will be presenting an incredible exhibition all about the Beatles Down Under. Tonight, Peter Cox from the Powerhouse Museum is here to tell us more about the exhibition and that tour. Peter, a very good evening to you.
Hi, Rod.
And the man who quite literally wrote the book on the Beatles Down Under is Glenn A. Baker, of course, well known to, well, everyone in Australia, music lovers, and especially nightlife listeners. Glenn, very good evening to you too.
A delight to be here, even though I had to give up the pretty things tonight.
The pretty things. Now, I'm wondering why that microphone is not working the way it ought to, but...
Should I just project? Should
let's
I
try this one the... there, and I'm going to cross our fingers.
Do I sound any better on that one?
Why we only ever get one microphone working in this
look,
place.
I know Peter well, but I don't know that we're actually that close that we can we can do a George and Paul.
I'm going to ask you to see if you can move over to that microphone.
But me? Excuses, folks. We're just playing games here.
That sounds all right.
What? Where? What? Hello? Back? Am I back here?
Yeah, that sounds all right.
Sounds okay?
Okay. Does it?
Anyway, we're talking about the Beatles, aren't we?
We are talking about the Beatles. Peter, what is the Powerhouse Museum doing?
Well, we're going to develop an exhibition to anticipate and mark the anniversary of the Beatles' tour of Australia, because it was a major event of the 1960s.
Why was it such a major cultural event, not just a big pop music event?
Well, I think it sort of marks a point where the 60s really took off in Australia. If you look at what was happening in the early 60s musically and culturally, it was more like a bit an extension of the 1950s, really. Mm. And I think the 1960s took off really around 1964 when a period of immense social change started to come upon us, not caused by the Beatles, but the Beatles were certainly part of this big period of change.
They were the catalyst for changes were occurring in the top half of the world that we suspected were occurring, because we got the newsreels and we got the newspaper reports. But until we had those four living, breathing organisms with their sort of, you know, their hair a little bit over their collar and a funny way of saying love, the four young gods from Liverpool in our presence, we couldn't quite understand how dramatically the world had changed.
Okay.
You're looking a bit worried. I am, because I'm no longer hearing you.
Why? Well, I can hear you, but the question is the rest of the world hearing you? For some reason, microphone three is working. I'm just going to ask if one of you could move on to this last microphone. We'll cross our fingers and see whether that works.
Perhaps we could just sing a little bit of Please, Please.
Well, what we will do, in fact, if we...
Just... How are we going then?
Ah.
Well, say some words,
Peter.
You sound
okay, but the point is, do you sound okay,
well,
Peter?
I hope I sound okay, right? Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I don't know what's going on.
Maybe we should just share a mic rock and roll style. Come back here, mate. Okay, here we go.
What I'm going to ask, though, we'll start with you, Glenn. We're going to play a little bit here, which is possibly the first connection the Beatles had with Australia. There was a little bit of a connection.
Well, all they really knew about Australia was that Rolf Harris played their Christmas shows at the Hammersmith Odeon. Yeah. And in fact, as I think we're about to hear, when Lennon tried to put on an Australian accent, it was so far from being an Australian accent, you're wondering where on earth he'd actually picked it up from. But, you know, we were the far-flung colonies. We were the place that nobody in the top half of the world had paid very much attention to at all. So it's very interesting that when we did become the location of the greatest outpouring of Beatle devotion ever in their entire span, the top half of the world still never really conceded it.
You say
the Beatles never spoke about it. I mean, they never... When they got back, it was almost like Brian Epstein took them aside and said, lads, if we go on about how crazy the Australians were, this is not going to sit well with our fans. Best we don't mention it. And they largely didn't mention it. Yet they'd had 350,000 people in the streets of Adelaide, 250,000 people in the streets of Melbourne. There was like nothing. When they finished the tour, by the way, they went back to Liverpool for the opening of A Hard Day's Night. 100,000 people turned out, and the British media were just beside themselves. Yes. Nothing like this has ever been seen. And you're thinking, you dimwits. It had just been seen a matter of weeks before in Australia, but you're not prepared to admit to
it. Okay, let's hear a little bit then of Waltzing Matilda.
Waltzing Matilda. Hello, Barry Farber. How's about playing our latest record? This is the Beatles speaking.
Here we go.
They later had a crack at Tommy Kangaroo Down Sport as well. That's also out
they
there.
They would have had a connection with Frank Ifield, though, as well. They would have known Frank
Keep
Ifield.
Keep in mind that Frank was an Englishman who came out here, spent a few years in Dural, and then went back to England. Okay. Yes, they knew Frank, but I don't know that they quite thought of him as much as they would Rolf as being an Australian.
I think they were the support act for Frank Ifield.
That's right. In fact, Frank tells the story about how this rather polite businessman from Liverpool, Brian Epstein, came and begged him, pleaded with him to please allow the Beatles to go out on tour. And as Frank says now, he said, my audience didn't like them very much. They weren't all that popular.
Peter, you got a theory about why they were so big in Adelaide?
I do. Adelaide was originally not going to be included on the Australian tour. It was only after a campaign spearheaded really by Bob Francis, the disc jockey, and Ron Tremaine, who had a magazine over there called Young Modern, in which they organised a petition which got 80,000 signatures.
Yeah.
And Ron Tremaine hopped on a plane, took it over to the promoter in Melbourne and sat in his office for 1.5 days patiently waiting to show him this petition to convince him that the Beatles should come to Adelaide. And, of course, they finally did after many twists and turns in that story.
Let it just be said that one of the reasons why was because it was the only occasion on the tour where they could and did make significant money, having agreed to do the tour for £1,000 a week, later increased to £1,500 a week, at the time when they were being offered $50,000 a show in America. So Adelaide presented itself as a very timely and useful.
So they were able to negotiate more because of the Adelaide shows.
But that's right.
Peter, your theory, though,
Well, in Adelaide, there were a lot of British migrants, a lot of recently arrived British migrants, and I think a lot of them were working in the northern suburbs of Adelaide, you know, the motor car.
Yeah. Elizabeth migrants.
Special town.
And a lot of these people were, it was so recently arrived, and some were from the north, that they'd seen the Beatles, you know, there.
Yeah.
And there was, I think, a sense of pride and ownership of them, and the sense that Adelaide was kind of Beatle town. And so the fervour was particularly strong there, partly because of that.
What have you got for the exhibition, Peter?
Well, we're doing this exhibition with the Arts Centre in Melbourne, who have a fantastic performing arts collection. Among their collection is an archive that was donated to them by the promoter of the Beatles exhibition, Ken Brodziak.
Yep.
And it's a fascinating set of documents that really tells the story, like Glenn was saying, about how they were signed up for such a small amount and then...
And would never have come had not Epstein been of the old school.
Yes, that's right. Well, we've signed it, we're coming.
Yeah, I'm a man of my word, and the Beatles will come.
Didn't John Lennon say something to Ken Brodziak, like...
We're doing this for the old price, aren't
we? That's right, yeah.
the interesting thing about this collection at the Arts Centre in Melbourne is the documentation there lets you look at that a bit more closely.
Oh, okay.
And there's a telegram there where after the Beatles have appeared on the Palladium performance in October of 63, when shortly after then the British press coins the term Beatlemania.
Mm. In fact, slow news day, it was said. But yes.
Brian Epstein, in fact, upped the price at that point to $2,500 a week. Now, that was for 12 performances, so he could have got 10 times that. You know,
slave wages.
So, he was a terrible.
He kind of did keep to his word in principle, but he upped it to £2,500 a week.
And it's worth keeping in mind how he came to have them anyway. I mean, he had an agent in London, Cyril Berlin, I think was his name, who was always offering him acts. But usually it was the sort of the MOR variety. Mm-hmm. But he sort of said, you know, Ken, there's something happening in England. There's all these new young groups. And he gave him a list of these acts. And as Brodziak says, he's sitting in his office and he's looking down this list of these groups. He said he hadn't really heard of any of them. Except I think it was the young guy who worked in his office in Melbourne, Malcolm, come to me a second, who would mention the Beatles to him. So something twigged and he moved his finger down and went,
Beatles.
Okay, I'll take the Beatles.
So if it had been the zombies, he never would have got to
Well, it's interesting, but he had, During the Pacemakers came here 3 months before the Beatles as the beginning of sort of like, you know, the Mersey invasion. They actually beat the Beatles here.
So what are you looking for, Peter?
Well, like I said, we've got access to this great archive. We've got in our collection and in the collection at the Arts Centre a lot of the merchandise that came out at the time, the vintage Beatles merchandise. But the sort of things we're looking for are kind of more unique personal items like... You know, for example, the other day I went and saw a woman who has a couple of things she took to the Beatles concert at the Sydney Stadium, and they are placards she made. And one says, "Ringo, how about a ring?" and has her telephone number.
Very
and
nice.
That's unique, and it's amazing she's kept it for 48 years.
Wow.
And she's going to lend that to us, and that'll go in the exhibition. So that kind of quirky...
What we're waiting for is the scarf, right? We don't know where... Yeah, the scarf that they... Well, it's on the front audience. Cover of my book and everything else, and it's the one that Mad Mel, the disc jockey at 2SM, one of the good guys, arranged for the followers to do. I don't know how long they sat there knitting, but it was presented to the Beatles. Was it presented at either the press conference or Paul's 22nd birthday party, I'm trying to think, which is the... I should know, I wrote the book.
Yes, but, I think it was that day.
It was that day, anyway. But who knows where that has gone to? It'd be wonderful to find it.
Well, it falls into the category of all the gifts that were showered upon the Beatles, which, you know, I guess were shipped back to England, and I think it says in your book some were distributed to the fan club, etc. So,
and children's hospitals everywhere else that they could shove teddy bears off to.
Exactly. Now, I'm going to ask this, Glenn, and then Peter, please, as well. You say the Beatles kind of never mentioned the tour again, but in fact, John did talk about it.
To Jan Wenner of Rolling Stone in the early 70s, where he described it as Fellini's Satyricon.
It was just
everything went on.
Morning,
but
noon,
until
and
then,
night.
I mean, you're not aware, are you, Peter, of them ever really talking about it or it
not
ever
the
really figuring
situation.
Or anything, really.
More interestingly, I'm not aware that the press let that out at the time. I think if it happened today, it would have been a scandal, but the press had a kind of conspiracy of silence about the behaviour that was going on.
John F. Kennedy enjoyed the same sort of protection that there were. Jim Oram, the now gone journalist who covered the tour, I mean, what he told me, and which I only used a little bit of in the book, was that really just anything went.
We should point out this book came out 30 years.
Yes,
oh,
I know.
Years
it's
ago,
staggering,
so people
isn't
can't
it?
Necessarily go out in stores and buy it, but hopefully it might be republished.
Well, it kind of rendered any other book about the Australian tour redundant because it's so complete.
Yeah. It has everything in it.
I was particularly intrigued at the time by just the reaction. Those number of people. I've been in Exhibition Street. I've looked up to the balcony of the Southern Cross. Mm. I've tried to comprehend the vast numbers of people. And actually, in the intro to the book, let me just read a paragraph in my own words. I said, "The Beatles, their presence and their lingering influence became a catalyst for the suppressed frustrations of kids who had begun to realise that unquestioning obedience to everyone older was no longer a sacred law. To a 16-year-old in 1964, standing outside a hotel in a public street, screaming at the top of one's voice was a breathtakingly daring act, an adrenaline-charged escape from the combined muzzle of school, parents and community standards." Mm. And it's hard to imagine now where you see, you know, One Direction turn up outside Channel 7 in Elizabeth Street or Castle Road, and, you know, the streets are full and the police are there. But once upon a time, the very idea of that happening, you had the Vienna Boys Choir would come and sit politely at press conferences and answer everything absolutely on cue. Nobody ever either gave cheeky answers in press conferences like the Beatles did, nor did their fans go out and march and scream and yell and cavort and do all those things.
We'll
the nature of Australia changed.
It did. Now, what was the tour like? How many shows did they play?
Oh, well, they played, 4 in Adelaide, 6 in Melbourne, 6 in Sydney and 4 in Brisbane.
That's it.
Then they went to New Zealand in the middle of all that.
Yeah, and they played in Dunedin. For anyone who knows their geography, the idea of the Beatles playing in Dunedin is an astonishing thing to even contemplate. And the interviews I dug up of them in places like Dunedin show them sounding very wearied indeed.
So
like, what are we
Australia,
doing here and when will we get home?
Played a couple of concerts, some concerts, then went to
three
New Zealand.
Yeah, 3.5 weeks they were in Australia and New Zealand when the whole world wanted them.
Yeah.
They just finished their first film. And they had to leave it in the hands of Dick Lester to cut it up and go to the bottom of the world where these strange people were behaving so oddly. I mean, it was like it was an incredible thing.
Yeah, Peter, have you got anything from New Zealand?
Well, look, we're not really going to try and tell that story. Okay. You know, the sort of stuff that survived from the New Zealand tour is over in New Zealand.
Okay.
And we've considered having that as a major part of it and trying to tour the exhibition there, but we're going to stick with Australia because that's a big enough story. And you know, it's our story, and it's the story that we can tell in this country. Any book you read about the Beatles, yeah, other than Glenn's book about, yes, the tour, when it comes to June of 1964... glosses over it with one sentence.
Right? And then cuts forward to the Hard Day's Night premiere, right, as if it just never, ever happened.
But there is a major reason we should talk about what happened, not only because it was here, but because many people have claimed to be the fifth Beatle. But on the Australian tour, and in fact,
there was a real fifth
in
Beatle.
In Europe, there was a fifth Beatle. His name was Jimmy Nichol. We'll talk about him in 20 seconds' time because we're just waiting Victoria or Melbourne to join us because they've been at the cricket. Everyone else has been with us and we'll take some calls.
They have no idea what we're talking about, are they?
They will
remember.
We've
covered all the best bits so far,
and yet we've barely touched the surface of that. Let me just count down 1, 2, 3, and we say on ABC Local Radio, you're with Rod Quinn. This is The Nightlife. It's Friday night. You are with Rod Quinn. And we are talking about the Beatles' 1964 tour of Australia. Because at the end of next year and then into 2014, a major exhibition will start in Sydney, move to Melbourne to commemorate 50 years since the most famous pop tour of Australia. Peter Cox is with us from the Powerhouse Museum.
A real curator.
Who's putting this together, and Glenn A. Baker, who
is not a curator,
we said, quite literally wrote the book on the 1964 Australia and New Zealand tour of the Beatles, by the Beatles. We would love to hear from you right now, 1-300-800-222, 1-300-800-222. Were you there? What do you remember? What do you see? Do you have something that they want for the Powerhouse?
Yes.
Now, even I've got a program, and I...
Hang on to it. They're increasing in value every day.
Okay, someone very kindly gave it to me. We're looking for personal items from people, perhaps you might have taken to the concert, or maybe you got a bit of Paul McCartney's sheets, because I think they sold them off later.
Yes, but what they did was, when they ran out of the ones that the Beatles had really slept on, and there was still great demand, they popped down to whatever the haberdashery shop that was nearby, and bought Albert and cut them up and send them out. So there's no way of knowing whether a Beatle slept on the sheet that you might have. It is worth mentioning,
maybe,
Rod.
Maybe someone slept on a Beatle. We'd like to hear about that as well.
That a number of notable Australians figure in this tour. Like in Melbourne, there was a young man, two young men, who screamed so loudly like girls that they were kicked out of Festival Hall and locked out. And they were...
Well, one I know was Ian Molly Meldrum.
And the other one was Ronnie Burns, who later would start a Beatle group called The Flies. And then up in Brisbane, where the Beatles were pelted with eggs and treated very, very badly by a group of university students, one of them now leads his own political party, and his name is Bob Catter. And then there is a young woman of Asian descent who had a romantic fling with a Beatle. We might graciously leave her name out of it, but
I think
she went on to become very famous. But she's traded on it herself.
I'm still reeling from the fact that Bob Catter was the Eggman.
Boom. Let's talk about where we were just before our friends in Melbourne joined us, and that is the fact that there was a fifth Beatle on this tour. His name was Jimmy Nichol. Ringo got tonsillitis, and so against George's better judgment... He thought they shouldn't. Ringo was the group. He was part of the group. They shouldn't have toured without Ringo. They'd just come back from America. They'd had the first tour of America, went back to England. Ringo got sick. They decided, well, we're going. We're on the tour. We'll get a spare drummer.
They were going the next day, you know, so to cancel the tour would have been very difficult.
Yeah.
They were playing Holland and Copenhagen, Denmark, and then Hong Kong.
Copenhagen, Amsterdam, Hong Kong, and then it would be Adelaide, which would be the last city of the four cities
so
that he played in.
Where did they get Jimmy Nichol?
He had been with Georgie Fame's Blue Flames.
Right.
He was a jazz guy, and he had a sort of jazz chops. What was funny is, you're right, they got him a day before the tour, yet there's an interview with him saying, yeah, man, I'm growing my hair. How much he could grow his hair in 24 hours, we're not entirely sure. But of course, the greatest sort of outpouring of all was Adelaide, and Jimmy was there. Ringo never saw Adelaide. Mm. And they adored him, so much so that when he got his £500 and a gold watch and went back to England saying, they've lined some things up for me, which they hadn't, he went back home and he cut a single for Pye Records. Now, you would have thought, you know, Rod, that having sort of been in the Beatle orbit of this wonderful raw beat music, and you know, that he would have learned a thing or two. He didn't. It sounds like a Tonight Show theme. Adelaide was the only place in the world that ever became a hit.
I like it. I think it's fantastic.
No, it's got a cool Brit, but it's more like Brubeck than Beatles. It's a weird thing, but it's called, Peter, it's called
Husky.
You go.
I gotta say, I like it. Not truly an instrumental after
Not truly
all.
An instrumental, but like I said, raced up the Adelaide charts.
1-300-800-222. Maybe you've got questions about the Beatles tour. Maybe your parents have told you stories about it. Maybe you were there. We want to hear from you. Would especially, Peter, you want to hear if...
Yes, indeed. Well, when the Beatles first arrived in Australia, it was on a very, very wet and windy Thursday morning. Sure.
Shocking day.
Yeah, terrible
June
day.
11, 1964. You know,
they said they'd never seen rain like it. And they were
from England.
They were paraded on the back of this open truck.
Milk truck.
Milk truck, they call it.
Shocking.
And as they came off the plane, now it was a BOAC plane, they had a sponsorship deal for this tour with Ansett A&A. Ansett A&A provided charter flights all around the country for free just to get the publicity to say they could carry the Beatles. Neither BOAC nor Ansett A&A thought to provide umbrellas for these guys who were going to be exposed to the elements the minute they stepped out of the door of the aircraft. So an enterprising person, and to this day we don't know who it was, from a rival domestic airline, TAA, ran up the gangway and gave the Beatles these TAA umbrellas, which in the photos and in the newsreel clips to this very day, TAA is emblazoned on their umbrellas
and,
you know, now.
And they never set foot in a TAA flight.
No. Now, but we want...
Well, we'd love to get hold of one of these umbrellas because on the 1st of August, it's in your book, Glenn, on the 1st of August...
It is? I wrote it a long time ago.
On the 1st of August, there was a preview screening of A Hard Day's Night in Sydney.
It was, yes. And I've got a Bob King photograph of it in the book, yes.
There was a barrel draw to give away as prizes three of these TAA umbrellas. Wow. And if Elizabeth Brown of Hurstville or Christine Reed of DY still has the TAA umbrella, would they please lend it to the Powerhouse Museum?
Please. We would like it. 1-300-800-222. Cole was there. Hello, Cole. Hang on, you'll need to put your headphones on. Hello, Cole.
G'day. How are you?
I'm very well.
Hi, Cole.
I have no idea how long my mother lined up in the queue to get the tickets, but I was in the fourth row from the front. It was unbelievable, you know, but all the young girls that were there, I don't know why they bothered going. All they wanted to do was scream and yell, and, you know, you could hardly hear them. But from the fourth row, I could actually hear them, you know, but behind you wouldn't have heard very much except the girls screaming out.
So what do you remember, though, about how they looked or whether they talked during the songs or just did they play the half-hour set and left?
They mainly played and a few comments between the songs, but not very much. It was mainly just playing and singing, you know.
Cole, here's something that to ponder. You think now of a rock concert that any headlining act plays automatically 90 minutes to 2 hours, unless you're Springsteen, where you play for 4 hours. Right. The Beatles played 22 minutes.
22?
11 songs, 22 minutes. That was it. Right. That was the performance. And that was as much as the young audience could bear. I mean, anything. But remember, you also had Sounds Incorporated and Alan Field, the comedian, and Johnny Devlin and Johnny Chester and Dinah Lee on some show. It was a full review. Yeah. But like I said, 22 minutes.
Have you still got your tickets or your program, Cole?
I did have them, but I've moved, and I'm not sure whether I've still got them or not.
No.
It's a shame. You know, I did have them for a long time.
Did they sell memorabilia there? I mean, were there, you know, T-shirts?
I'm not sure of that. I would have just...
There was no merch stand. It's a bit early.
I would have kept, you know.
All righty, Cole. But,
it's the only time I've ever been to the stadium, you know, and that's gone now because that's where the Eastern Suburbs Railway went through.
Right. You know, Cole, it's also worth keeping in mind it's a wonder anybody could hear anything because I think they played through a 100-watt amp. Yeah. I think you actually have more power now in your home stereo. And their vocals came through, I think, about a dozen tin horns hanging from the pillars around the stadium. That was
right.
It. That was
right.
And, of course, they didn't bring their own PA system. They had to rely on what was in each venue at the time.
God. Sure. Was there a sound check, do we know? Or?
Not that I'm aware of. No, I'm not aware of them.
They just turned up, plugged in and played.
But one thing that's interesting is that it's become like, you know, common parlance that the Beatles couldn't hear themselves and the girls were screaming so loud that they just played any old thing.
Yeah.
Well, my good friend Bruce Hamlin, who runs the Beatles Records Information Service, he's made a study of listening to every live performance of the Beatles in the 60s. Wow. And he said they didn't actually goof off. Yeah. They were on the money each time. In fact, I think, Peter, you've brought along some live performance from Australia. They actually did take seriously what they were doing and played sharp.
Okay, we should be able to play that in a minute, I hope. I'll try and find that. Thanks very much, Cole. Sherry is next. Good day, Sherry.
Sherry. Hello, Cole.
Sherry, baby. Yeah. It's Rod here. We've got Glenn A. Wrong Baker group. And Peter Cox as well.
Hi.
What do you remember? You were there at Festival Hall.
I was at Festival Hall in 1964. My father took me and five girlfriends to Festival Hall for my 13th birthday.
Brave man.
And it was. And he said, I remember him saying ever afterwards that at one stage he opened his mouth and screamed as loudly as he could and he couldn't hear himself. So he wondered what we were all doing there. But I also have, as a piece of memorabilia, a piece of streamer that Paul McCartney touched. Someone threw this yellow streamer during the performance, and he wound it round the microphone stand. And at the end of it, we went out past that, and we went up and we grabbed a piece of the streamer, and I remember rolling it up really carefully so that my fingers didn't touch anywhere that he had touched. And I still have that piece of streamer.
You may find that in a museum very soon,
yes.
Sherry.
I can see Peter noting things down here.
You may very well get a call from Peter. Don't worry about it. I've got your number, Sherry. How long were you a Beatles fan?
I grew up as a Beatles fan, and I was a fan right through the whole time that the Beatles were playing, and I'm still a Beatles fan.
Okay, who could ever forget
it? It's an interesting thing, Sherry, about the Festival Hall performances, because that was where they filmed the TV show.
The Beatles Sing for Shell.
That's right, and it's such a fantastic document of that tour. The sound quality is really good, and I find it really interesting when you listen to it. John Lennon's guitar seems to be very, very loud, much more louder than on the recordings, and you get a really good sense of his guitar work. You know, he does the lead solo, and you can't do that, and on All My Loving, he's doing that deedly, deedly, deedly thing, and he's a fantastic player.
Well, I think
you know, I have to convince that at 13, I think that really I was more interested in screaming and being there than listening to their great play.
And was it Paul that you were screaming at mostly?
Yes, it was Paul. So I was a Paul fan.
Your favourite Beatle.
Yes,
because that's the thing, you've got to have a favourite Beatle. Sherry, thank you very much for that. And
it's
I think Peter may be giving you a call. This is what they sounded like. Sounds like a plane coming in, but I've got to say, kids
I haven't
still
played
scream.
Anything yet.
No, they haven't. The kids are going mad.
I'll get to it in a second.
They will. But I went to see Taylor Swift a couple of years ago, and the girls are screaming exactly the same way. Oh, nothing has changed.
I was at One Direction, fourth row centre, with a young friend of the family. I think, and you're right, it doesn't change. But anyway,
here we go.
Let's hear it. You know what I mean.
Oh, since I saw her stand.
There they were doing, I saw her standing there.
Battle-hardened, road-hardened from those years in Hamburg, where they would play 6 and 7 and 8 hour, and being told, make sure.
Make a good show. Put on a good show.
That was it. And by the time they got on the road, Lennon particularly was solid duty.
Okay, Peter, good evening. Hello, Peter.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, mate. Tell me your Beatles story.
No, I've not much to tell. My wife's got a pair of stockings with the Beatles all over them. She was in Melbourne when they toured Melbourne.
Fantastic.
She couldn't get tickets for them, but she was in the street there, apparently.
Okay, one of the 250,000.
Do you have the original packaging for the stockings?
I think she has, yeah.
Fantastic. Okay, well, you know, they'd be worth a bob or two.
If
you hold the stockings up into the light, you know, the actual fabric has images of the Beatles on them.
Really?
Yeah.
Ooh, okay. Mm. You weren't a Beatle fan, Peter? Your wife was.
Oh, yeah. We've got all the old vinyl records at home. And my grandkids get them out now and give them a run every now and again.
I'm glad to hear that, Peter.
They love them.
All right, thanks very much for that. 1-300-800-222, 1-300-800-222. We want to hear your Beatle memories. Don't wait for the next 10 minutes. We'll be out of time. Peter, sorry.
When the Beatles played in Brisbane, of course, they played at Festival Hall there. And Festival Hall was closed in 2003 and was demolished.
Yep.
And there was an auction of the seating at Festival Hall. They were sold in lots of three seats.
Oh.
If anyone out there has seats from Festival Hall, we'd be very keen to borrow that too.
It's amazing, isn't it? The stadium's gone. Festival Hall is gone. Those three airlines you mentioned, BOAC gone, ANZANA gone, TAA gone. So all that, I know it's 50 years ago, but still, a lot of this stuff gone. Okay, now we're starting to get a million people ringing. Sue, good evening.
What have we awakened?
Hello. Yes. Look, I wasn't at a concert, but I vividly remember the Beatles' 64 trip to Australia.
Yes.
I was a 19-year-old student nurse in Lismore in northern New South Wales.
Yes.
Couldn't afford to go to Sydney to see them. One of my colleagues was going because she was much smarter with the money than what I was.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had instead a Beatles dance at the Lismore City Hall.
Wow, what a great idea.
Screamed and danced to A Hard Day's Night. I can even remember what I was wearing. It was just great. It was just the best night, and I can remember it as well as if it was today.
Isn't that lovely? Now, what did your friend tell you when she came home?
Oh, it was just lovely, but all that she could remember was just screaming, and it was just so exciting they could hardly hear because they just screamed. They were just so excited.
Okay.
I think that they sort of nearly were, you know, unconscious with just the screaming.
All right. Thanks very much for that, Sue. We've got a full board of calls right now. Shane, this will be a good one. G'day, Shane.
Good evening.
Yes, your best friend's father owned Festival Hall.
That's correct.
In Melbourne?
Yep, so I had a wonderful teenage life.
Yeah, I bet you went to every concert.
Well, I saw most of the shows that came out, yeah.
And what do you remember about the Beatles?
Well, we had the advantage that at Festival Hall there's a small balcony up the back. So we were seated up there, and because it was above everyone else, you could actually hear them.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
Huh? You're one of the few people in Australia that actually heard the Beatles on their tour.
Yep.
And were you impressed?
Oh, yes, they were wonderful.
Okay.
And yes, they played in tune and they played together and they were tired as anything.
Oh, and who else did you see, Shane?
Everybody. All faces. I saw Bob Dylan and the band when they came out and he was doing his double acoustic electric tour and all the losers who left at half time.
Truly they were, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
Crazy.
The band demonstrated that a rock band could play like an ensemble. It was brilliant.
Good point. Hey, Shane, thank you very much for that. Kay, good evening.
Oh, yes. Hi, Rod. Look, I was busily preparing to be married in the June of 64, so I've got my 50th wedding anniversary coming up, but I was dying to get to the concert because I just love them. But
did you go?
No, I just got so snowed under.
With your wedding?
With all my wedding plans. But
wedding schmitting, you can get married any day. Time. This was the Beatles.
I know. And look, but my husband was in all the Beatle gear, the thin tie, the pointed shoes. He looked fantastic anyway. But what I didn't know at the time 1963, I worked at the Reserve Bank of Australia, full of great girls. We were going to a party, couldn't wait to get there. It must have been, I think, October or even a little bit earlier. Some guys who had been on a ship had arrived and come to our party. They had an album. They said, "You can't wait to hear who this is." He said, they're a smash in England. We hadn't heard them on the radio here.
Oh, okay.
Guess what it was?
The Beatles.
Please Me, the album.
Yeah, okay.
And, of course, we're dancing the night away with I Saw Her Standing There, of course.
Of course. First track, side one.
Yep.
First
so
album.
I love them from the beginning. Still love them now.
Okay.
Yep.
All righty. Hey, thanks very much for that, indeed.
Rod, I just want to mention something before we do run out of time. It is, of course, we all remember the early hours of June 11, 1964, when they arrived and went around the perimeter of the airport at Mascot in the rain. But that wasn't their first stop on Australian soil.
No,
they had not, at about 2 a.m., they had landed in Darwin, because that was in the days when, you know, any trip from any part of the world required stops for refueling every few hours.
Well, it was an unscheduled stop, and because there were heavy winds.
That's heavy wind. But it was interesting to know what the first words said to the Beatles on Australian soil were.
Yeah.
And it's the one of the... let me see.
Now, Glenn is trying to cue me in on this.
I'm trying to cue you in on this to play track three.
But this will only play... It says there's one track which is 36 minutes
long. Oh, so they've not broken it up. Okay, well, I will tell you, I believe it was a disc jockey by the name of John Edwards, as I say.
That's right.
He was hastened out to the airport, and the first words addressed to the Beatles on our soil were, "Welcome to Australia. Which one am I talking to?"
That's right.
And immediately John said, "Paul."
Because they're all the same, after all. Hello, Sarah.
Hi. I was lucky enough when I was 14 to go to the concert.
Yeah.
And my memories of it was that it was very, very loud, but also that I just felt, with my girlfriend, we just felt so lucky that we were breathing the same air as the Beatles.
Oh, isn't that lovely?
And, you know, they were tender little characters. When they were taken to the beach at the Gold Coast and they were let loose on the sand, they wore their socks because they said that their tender British feet would be cut by the sharp Australian sand. So he was the Fab Four frolicking on the Gold Coast with their socks on.
Do you remember it was difficult to get tickets, Sarah, or not?
I don't know. What I do remember, though, is that my girlfriend and I were all dressed up and thought we were super cool. But it was that a mother came up with her younger child. We were 14, so the mother must have had a little 10-year-old and said, "You look like nice girls. Would you look after our little Sharon?"
Okay. Yeah.
So we thought, we don't look as cool as we have to.
All right. Thanks very much, Sarah. Lisette, I think, or Lisette?
Lisette, yes.
Hello.
Hello.
What do you remember about the tour?
Well, it was my 14th birthday present. My brother was allowed to take me. He's about 20 at the time. And I remember that he told me before we went in that I was not allowed to scream and I had to behave myself. So we went in, sat down about two-thirds of the way up the festival, back at the festival hall in Brisbane, and the Beatles ran on stage and it was just so exciting. The whole audience stood up and started to scream before that even started playing.
Well, that's right. And why wouldn't you?
And they all stood on their seats. My brother and I looked at each other and he shrugged his shoulders.
And said, "You may as well go ahead and scream."
Yeah.
But you know, Lisette, the audiences were crazy and wild and seemingly uncontrollable. And yet, on their first concert in Adelaide, it was reported in the press that amidst all this madness, when the national anthem played, everyone in the audience stopped dead, stood up in absolute silence.
I don't believe it.
Yeah, absolutely. The national anthem stopped them in their tracks.
And what anthem was it? It was God Save the Queen.
It was God
Queen.
Save the exactly Queen. Right. That's right.
On the text message service, K-Man said, "I was staying at the same hotel in King's Cross, the Sheraton Hotel, and wondered what all the commotion was about."
The balcony's still there where George came out in the towel.
Wearing a towel.
That's
exactly.
They've never torn it down.
Michael, good evening.
Good evening, chaps. How are you all?
Very well, mate. Good. What's your story?
I saw the Beatles at Festival Hall on the Queen's birthday evening.
Yep.
In 64.
Right.
And I'll just briefly mention, too, there's a show that's been running in Melbourne for many years called The Beatles Show.
Okay, yes.
Now, I have tapes from that, which had Brett McCausland. They had an interview with him. He was the man that ran on the stage and shook John Lennon's hand.
Wow. Right.
Peter is very interested.
You've got his name.
He's really interested.
I also have Dick Lean, interview with Dick Lean, who was the manager of stadiums. Ken Rodziak as well.
Right.
David Glide from Sounds Incorporated. A friend of mine has one of his saxophones.
Wow. Okay. Oh. Now, and, this is just what we want.
I think we're thinking of bringing David in and putting him on like a permanent display.
Absolutely.
Feeding him three meals a day and having him stand in the corner.
Wow. Well, I don't know whether he's still alive.
Oh, you bet he is.
He was living in Queensland, the last I heard.
Well, that's almost equivalent.
Yes.
That is brilliant, Michael. We have, I hope, got your phone number, and we will be, I'm sure that Peter Cox will be in contact with you. So thank you so much for that, mate. We're just starting to run out of time, unfortunately. Terry, good evening.
Oh, g'day.
You saw them at Mascot Airport.
No, I was given the day off school to watch it on television.
Oh, right,
the landing.
Okay.
You had a particularly enlightened school, because many schools forbid their students or forbade their students to even mention the word Beatles, have any involvement at all.
I mean, my mother let me stay home.
Oh, your mother let you? Okay. She was enlightened.
Yeah, she was enlightened, so that was great. Okay. And I went to the concert at the stadium.
Yep.
And what I can remember was, I think Ringo may have played that night. I know there was an issue of him being sick at that
time. That's right, yes.
And I think
he played in Sydney, yes.
Yeah, and that was the first night he played, so that was a bit of a buzz.
No, Melbourne was, in fact, the first night he played. But
the photos for the cover of Beatles for Sale, I think, were taken at the Sydney concert, got Ringo on it.
Okay.
All right, Terry, thank you very much for that. We've got to get to Stephanie, because she was there in Wellington in New Zealand, Stephanie.
I was indeed.
I understand the sound system wasn't so good in Wellington.
Well, how can I tell?
That's right.
But one of the interesting things was the night before, of course, it was a wet Wellington night, you know, as it only can be at that time of the year. And in the days of the old billboards advertising the next day's newspaper, the billboard that night said, "Beatles arrive," was a big black line, and then "Summit fails."
Oh, well, it was a political summit.
Well, I'm not sure which summit it was now, because it was a long time ago, but it was something international.
But who cares?
Exactly. Steph, thank you very much. Was it the Summit of Beauty and Love? Finally, Dawn, good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
Fine. You were in Adelaide.
I was, and I saw the concerts in Adelaide. I was at school at the time, and we actually had to line up, and our school was very disturbed about that. But we lined up with the boys, and we lined up for one day, one night, to get the tickets. And we finally got the tickets, and we went to the Beatles in Adelaide. And, of course, Ringo wasn't there, but the others were, and it was just amazing. Mm.
Fantastic story. Dawn, thank you very much. She experienced Adelaide. Peter, yes?
There's one item we have in the Powerhouse Museum collection that we will be putting in this exhibition, and we don't know where it came from, but it's a kind of very crudely made, well, it looks like a store display that would appear in a record shop, but it's these painted figures of the Beatles.
Ooh, okay.
Done in a very kind of naive style. But
that's a polite way of putting it.
You plug it in, and their heads bob from side to side, and their hands go up and down playing their instruments.
Yeah.
And we've bought it from an antique shop in Mittagong. We'd love to know if anyone out there knows of the origins of this particular item.
Wow, okay.
I'm just reading my own intro to the book I wrote years ago. And there's one short part, and I think this sums up everything I thought about when I was writing. And I said, "Australia reacted to the visit by the Beatles with such fervour because, young and old, it was crying out for tangible manifestations of the new freedoms which were emerging in England and America, freedoms it didn't quite understand. The Beatles were a sign from above, a skewer to lance the boil of stifling conservatism."
Wow.
And they lanced it so effectively, mate, that musically and culturally, the minute they left, we changed irreparably.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the old way of having pop groups or variety acts all changed. Everybody grew their hair. Everybody became a quartet or a quintet like the Stones. It just happened immediately.
Yeah.
We became a different country as a consequence of these four young gods from Liverpool sort of, you know, walking amongst us.
Peter, if people have got things, you know, what would you like? They can contact us or they can contact the Powerhouse Museum.
They can contact the Powerhouse Museum.
Or the Arts Centre in Melbourne, maybe.
Well, no, the Powerhouse Museum.
Powerhouse is the best place.
Just leave a message for Peter Cox.
Peter Cox at the Powerhouse Museum. Glenn A. Baker, I think it's time to republish that book, by the way.
Yes, I think. But...
Oh, no. Peter Cox has put his head in his hands.
No, only because we both thought it was a good idea, but it's... No, never mind. We'll see what happens.
All righty. Glenn A. Baker, Peter Cox, thank you very much.